So it's the 29th of September 2023, and we're here with John, Jonas, and Gavin. We're doing, John's looking at Jonas's manifold for Starbase Celestics. Jonas was born on the, get the glasses right, 13th of June 1970 at 7:30 in Latvia.
So my purpose, what I'm going to attempt to do here, is threefold. So I'm going to talk about the horoscope. So we'll do a little astrology, okay? And then I'm going to talk about the teroscope, which is the conversion that I made. And that's important because using the teroscope and other tools that I worked out is compatible with Starbase. So that's called ASB, or astrology for Starbase. So my third objective is, while we're in the course of going over the details of this manifold and the horoscope, to give some pointers on how the whole thing works.
Good.
How the whole enchilada works together.
Go on then.
Okay. So we'll start with, let's say, we have items on the table, like they introduce items in a courtroom. So these are what they call exhibits, the exhibits for the case. You know, so we're gonna try Jonas for the crime of being alive, and we have these 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 exhibits, and I will put them together and indicate them so that we can copy them, and they will be in the unit that will contain this talk. Follow me?
Yeah.
Make a unit of it. So we start with an astrology chart, and this is from Astrodienst. And even though we work with our own Starbase software, it's routine for a celestician to cast the horoscope because we want to confirm exactly three things, which are the ascendant or rising sign, the midheaven, which is the highest point in the sky at birth, and the moon. And we get the exact positions in the astrological chart, and then we go look at our software, and sometimes our software has those positions, but sometimes due to anomalies that we're working out, it doesn't. So that's why a celestician will always go and cast a horoscope.
Horoscope.
Okay? So where do I start? Well, when we look at, I'll give you some background on astrology for Starbase, and maybe that will make it easier to see how the unique system of astrology that I developed interfaces with celestics, right? Because astrology, as you know, is sign-based, and celestics is star-based, so, you know, how do they work together? So give me the opportunity, which might take 10 minutes, to show how I work this out, because whoever listens to this in the future, I think it would be helpful if they knew the problem that I faced and how I solved that problem. So back in the 70s, I was putting together the sidereal model of the zodiac with the 13 constellations, which are irregular in shape and extent. And at a certain point, as illustrated, I think, in On Nemata, I developed this blue diagram of my map of the constellations. And because I wanted to interface it with the signs, I cut it out in a circle, and I glued it over the horoscope. So inside you have the horoscope with the signs, and outside you have, but it didn't work. I couldn't do it at first. And the reason why it didn't work is evident here in Jonas's horoscope from Astrodienst. You see, they have these things called house systems. And house system is a way to use spherical trigonometry to locate things in the sky. So you locate the ascendant and the midheaven by this house system. And there are about six house systems, and they were developed by monks in the Middle Ages. And the one that's most commonly used, the one that they use here, is called Placidus. You see, it says right there. So it's a system of spherical geometry that they use to locate the planets around the Earth. But it has many faults in it. And one of the faults is that it makes the signs, it compresses and expands the signs so that they do not uniformly fit around the zodiac, but they're compressed and expanded. And when I saw this, I realized that I couldn't use the horoscope because you cannot accurately project from the horoscope into the sky. So I had to create another tool, which is called a taroscope. And this is an example I'll show you. This is my chart in the horoscope, the original form. And you see how it locates the planets in 12 sections, which are called the houses. And that depends on the house system that you're using. And this is the taroscope. And you see that it locates the planets in slightly different houses. Well, this is really, really important. Because if an astrologer was reading Jonas's chart, they would find the planets in certain positions. For instance, they would find Venus in the eighth house. But when you convert it to the taroscope, you find Venus in the ninth house, which I call the ninth facet. So I indicated 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9 places where the house position would change when you convert it to a taroscope. Now that's really important. Because if someone, an astrologer, was saying to you, oh, you know, you have Venus in the eighth house, and then they would use the formulas and they would describe to you the psychology of the eighth house. And they would say, your Venusian talent or ability or capacity must be applied to the areas of the eighth house, which contains a certain number of activities. But no, they would be completely misdirecting you, because the taroscope gives a more accurate model, and it places Venus in the ninth house, see?
Which corresponds more to the reality in the sky.
For instance, the ninth house is the house of long journeys and traveling. And Venus in the ninth house means that you would develop your Venusian sensibility, your appreciation of aesthetics and art and literature by traveling both mentally and physically to many different countries, which is accurate. But if the astrologer read your Venus in the eighth house, they would direct you toward a different realm of activities, which is social interaction. And obviously you haven't achieved the expression of Venus through social interaction. You've done it more through your solitary journey, you see?
Exactly.
So, and this is really, really fucking serious. So I consider that the correction of the taroscope is absolutely essential for reading astrology properly. This tool is not, is a bad tool. And as I said, there are six or eight different geometrical house systems. So which one are you going to use? Most people use the Placidian system. Okay, so far so good. I said it would take a while to elaborate on this, but it's good for me to get it off my chest because I've never explained this to anyone verbally, face to face, ever.
You know?
So the other point is what? The other point about the house system, okay, first point, you can't project the planets in an astrology chart into their correct positions in the sky. It doesn't work. Second point, the astrology chart by its house system gives you the wrong locations. You see, a house, what I call a facet, say these are the 12 facets. House is an area of life, like the second house is finances, security, money. Seventh house is marriage and arrangements. And so if they say you have a planet in a house and they direct you to that context, they're directing you to the wrong context. See? So that's the major development. The other thing I'll just say is that when you look at the structure of the horoscope, you find something really amazing. When I developed this in the 70s, and I worked a lot with what was called projective geometry. And this is something that was developed by anthroposophists, namely a woman called Olive Witcher, whom I met in the UK, and another man, George Adams. And projective geometry is a certain way of working with the beauty of geometrical structures. And so this pteroscope is not merely a space-location device, right? You got that?
Yeah.
Houses a, it's also a mandala of the merger of space and time. It's actually a mandala more than a location system. And it's a beautiful mandala because it's structured not on a 12 paradigm, but on a 4-8 paradigm, which is much more sophisticated. So when you look at the structure of the pteroscope, just in itself with nothing in it, you see four arrows coming in. See that? First house, fourth house, seventh house. Four arrows coming in. This is like time coming into space. And then you see four arrows going out. And this is like space expanding through time. So it's a much more sophisticated concept.
It's beautiful.
Than just a space location concept. Mm-hmm. And I worked that out through Goethe, and I worked that out through protective geometry, and I have a whole, in the archives, there's a whole folder that shows exactly how I worked it all out. And it's really, really beautiful. The final thing I'll say about the pteroscope is I made this radical change, which would have astrologers absolutely screaming their heads off. I said, okay, for centuries, ever since astrology was developed, they said the ascendant or rising sign is the cusp of the first house. So here's your ascendant or rising sign. It's 28 degrees of Scorpio, rising sign. And they say it's the cusp of the first house. It's the boundary of the first house. And here's the first house. And I said, no, 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 I'm not going to rehab. I'm going to fuck that system. And I'm going to say that the ascendant is in the center of the first house. It's not the boundary above or below. It's the center. That's one of the great heresies of my revision. And what I like about that is that it makes sense. Because look what happens when you look at the dawn sky. Doesn't it get light before the sun actually rises?
Absolutely.
Right?
Absolutely.
So this is the 15 degrees of the sky that gets light before the sun rises. And this is the 15 degrees that gets light after. And I said, that makes a lot of sense to me, observationally.
Yes.
So I'm bragging.
We do have an amateur astrologer here.
Someone who was interested in the topic for a long time. And just by chance, Bazaar, happens to be sitting in for this talk, which you, of course, can listen to over and over if you'd like. So I really did it, you know, this is a tremendous piece of work. But when I finally had the pteroscope, which is an equal house system, then I could put this blue wheel around it, and every position in the pteroscope would go right to where it is in the sky. Okay?
Transposition to the real sky.
Yeah, from the sign position right into the real sky, exactly where it is. So then we'll get back, we'll start looking at your chart for a moment. The other item of evidence I brought up here is the conversion I did of the 12 symbols of the signs. So I scrapped all the symbols that astrologers usually use, and I did my own symbols of the 12 signs. So on your pteroscope, on your horoscope, you see the traditional symbols.
Yeah.
Aries to Pisces. But on the pteroscope, you see my symbols.
Okay. That's your second heresy.
Yeah, that's another one. And there's a few others.
You filthy revisionist.
I know, it's horrible. I don't know how I can live with myself. So, what we do now is we, where do we start? Okay, we've covered this. In the items of evidence included with this talk, you'll see my original horoscope, and then you'll see my teroscope. And then we have Jonas's horoscope, Jonas's teroscope. Okay?
And Jonas's rim sight.
And Jonas's rim sight and Jonas's manifold. Okay? So what are we going to do? Well, let's see. Oh, yes. Last thing I want to say. The other, and this is a really big issue, and I don't think I've ever debated this with an astrologer. Because you go to an astrologer, and they will look at your horoscope, which I'm looking at here, and they will say, look at this. Moon conjunct Uranus in the 10th house. Not in the 10th house in the teroscope, right? And it was, and then they will give you advice. And the way they typically give you advice is syntactically wrong. Because the advice they give you is they say, oh, moon conjunct Uranus in the 10th house, you have such a talent to be a professional entrepreneur. And you have brilliant ability. You're like a dreamer with your moon in library. You're always trying to figure out, you know, how to blend things and balance things out. But with your Uranian genius, you come up with ideas, and you come up with many different original ideas that you then can convert to projects in a professional field, because the 10th house is traditionally profession, social status. You have the opportunity to achieve great social status with this skill of the moon Uranus in the 10th house, right? Completely wrong. It obviously not true. It's not true, is it?
Because it's not in the same house.
Yeah, but not only that, it's not true because of the syntactical error. The error is that an astrologer assumes that any planet in any house indicates your ability to do something, that you already have that ability. And when I started to work on the language, the syntax of terra astrology, as I called it, I said, no, that's not it. I said, you take a planet and it's in a house and it's in a sign, okay? What do those two things mean? What they mean is that the sign, say the sign of Uranus in the house, which is here in the 11th house and not the 10th. The sign is what you need to develop. The area of the house, excuse me, is the area of life where you need to develop that skill. But I don't assume that you've already developed it.
Because you have to claim it.
You have to claim it and work it. So I don't assume that, oh, you already have this gift. You know, like, oh, you're a Gemini with the sun in the 3rd house. What a brilliant communicator. No, you're not. You have to learn how to communicate. So there are two formulas of syntax that are essential to this method: need to develop and need to express. So I would say Uranus in Libra in the 11th house shows that you need to develop your Uranian power in the context of the 11th house, and you need to develop it in the style of Libra. And I do not assume that you've already done that. And that completely turns the whole thing on its head. So you're not feeding the ego of the client by saying, oh, you're great at this, and you have Jupiter in the 7th house in Aquarius. What a wonderful New Age healer you'll be. Trash all that. What you're telling them is what they need to develop and how they need to express it. I was really, really happy. And then I was able, in many chart readings, to use that, and it was really successful. But you can see it's a major reworking. It's like taking the engine and transmission out of a car and putting a new engine and transmission in it. It's basically what I did, so I'll finish bragging. Okay, any comments? They're all in a coma.
Crickets.
It should be a video, and you could see them. Jonas, his tongue is hanging out. He's leaning over his chair, drooling. Coma. Okay.
Okay, let's go on the manifold then.
We'll go directly to the manifold.
Good.
I could sit here and talk for a while about Jonas's pterascope, but maybe we'll refer to that as the manifold.
That works.
Comes up. So, the manifold is obviously in two parts. One is the graphics, which you get from Starbase, that shows this rim site, the zodiacal model, and it projects the planets into exactly where they are in the constellation. And the other is the tabulation, or the readout of that. Okay? So now I'm going to talk about what I saw. And I spent about 10 minutes on this. Okay? So here goes. The myth you love and the myth you live. Now, this might seem at first like, don't I love the myth I live and don't I miss the, you do. You love the myth you live and you live the myth you love. But you do it in a particular balance between the two. So the manifold in the position of the sun establishes the myth that you're living, which is the way that you discover what the meaning of your life is. But opposite that, the earth is the myth you love, which is the way that you give to life something that was not there before. The way that you contribute to life, that is the myth you love compared to the myth you live, right? So you have the sun in 23 Gemini, which is between the horn tips of the bull, and it's close to the northern tip, which is the Morbido or El Na. So the myth you love is basically the myth of the bull, which is like, first of all, a love of beauty, natural beauty, right? And also a love of the power of imagination, because the bull is the force of imagination. But it's imagination that is trained by the senses. It's not fantasy imagination. It's imagination that goes to the real world.
Yeah.
So this is the myth you love, and this is how you discover and develop and expand the basic drive of your life. The drive, the stamina that drives you is the sun. It's vital force, it's prana. This is what drives you on your journey in life. But then when you look at the earth, that's what you learn that allows you to add something that wasn't there before. It's the unique contribution of your life. So every one of us, wherever the earth is in the constellations, shows the unique contribution of our life, of the entire summation of your life. That helps. The computer is wheezing. So you see, that's a simple formula. And how does it go? The beauty
of the myth you love.
Of the myth you love. Engenders and directs the power to live it. That's called the rule of psyche. The beauty of the myth that you love is the bull, engenders and matches the power to live it. Okay? Excuse me. That is the snake tamer. Excuse me. Your earth is in the snake tamer. So let me say that again. The beauty of the myth you love, which is the snake tamer, which is the shaman, which is the magician, which is the one who explores the mysteries of life and death, engenders and matches the power to live it, which is the sun in the bull. I got it correctly. The language is excruciatingly precise in this syntax, but it's like playing music. You pick up a guitar, you can pick up a flute, and maybe you can play, and it doesn't sound too bad. But if you master, it's very precise. Every note is precise. So similar to that.
To play and to play the duende is not the same thing.
That's right. So the earth is the truth you stand on. It's the myth you love. And in your case, it's the snake tamer. In the legs of the snake tamer.
The shaman.
Yeah, the shaman. And also the one, yes, that's right. It's in the leg of the snake tamer above the stinger of the scorpion. So all those mysteries of life and death, the lure of the supernatural, you know, that is the myth you love. And that it is from that that you contribute something uniquely. You know, and what you discover in the course of life, and there's what you make of it. And what you make of it is the earth and the constellations. By the way, going back to the telescope, when I did the telescope, I included the earth in my astrological work. And I used to talk to other astrologers and said, what the fuck? I said, well, how can you leave out the most important planet? Where is the earth in your horoscope? It's always opposite the sun. So that's very clear. Those are called the primaries. So then what other things caught my attention was the moon, okay? And the moon is in 10 degrees of the sign Libra, but that is in the constellation of the Virgin right here, and it is the Grail Cup. It is the place where she holds the cup of the Grail, marked by the stars in the Maya tricks, okay? So you have the moon at the Grail Cup, right? And we call that the sign of the Grail Keepers.
Grail family.
The Grail family. See, she has, I have Neptune at the Grail Cup. And a lot of us have that indication. So that symbolizes what is called your prescience. The moon indicates prescience. And prescience is that power that children have at an early point in life of foreknowing without being able to define what you know.
I know you that.
Yeah. People would call it intuition.
They don't have the syntax.
Yeah, they don't have the mental syntax. But what happens is that the moon capacity works through life in such a way that it's drawing or guiding you, like the power of the moon guides and draws your gaze across the sky. It draws you by the moonlight. It draws you to your vocation and your calling in life, even before you have the mental syntax to say, this is what I want to do. This is what interests me the most.
It's like a diamond.
It's like a light that directs you, like a beacon, a diamond, right? Mm. So you had that from an early age, drawing you toward the mysteries of the Grail, and there are many aspects of the mysteries of the Grail, you know, science and the study of true nature, study of the working of the natural world, because her body is the Grail, nature is the Grail. So you were drawn toward that, and your attention in very early years took you to that interest until the point where life brought you a way to define exactly what it was. That's called prescience. Right? I don't know what the equivalence of that would be in French, but it's the foreknowing.
La prescience.
La prescience, right? Le même mot. Plus ou moins. Okay?
Precognition.
Precognition, intuition, right? So that places you squarely in the Grail family, as if you didn't know already. Okay. Now let's look at the North Node and the South Node. Now the nodes are not planets. They are aspects of the orbit of the moon. And so are the apogee and perigee. So celestics uniquely includes these aspects, and no other system of astrology does. They include the nodes, but they do not include the apogee, which is the point most distant, when the moon is most distant from the earth, and the perigee when it's closest. So they're incorporated into this database. So the nodes are really important in the understanding of the emotional and intellectual development of a child. And we find that every child has what can be called a point of excess and a point of empathy, right? So the North Node is excess, and the South Node is empathy. And these, I established these when I wrote Quest for the Zodiac back in 1998. What this means is that every child has a tendency, on the one hand, to want to go to the other children around it and bring something to them, something that it's passionately interested in, you know? Like, I could give you an example from my own chart. I lived in a maritime climate, and there were some estuaries in Maine and some rivers. And when I went out to play at the age of 10 or 12 with my cousins, I was always saying to them, hey, let's build a raft. I want to sail on a raft, you know. Why don't you get, look, we have this wood left over from the boatyard. Let's build this raft and let's sail up the river to Waldoboro, you know. And I could never get them interested. But it was the typical behavior of a child who wants to, who comes forward with an idea or a plan and tries to get others to be interested in it. That's called the excess. It's an outreach. So for Jonas, that is the north node in the Manitou. And the Manitou is the pathfinder of the zodiac. The Manitou is the spirit of the wilderness. It's the being that leads us on the vision quest into the wilderness. So even as a child, there were things, and you can describe exactly what they are, where he was with his peers, you know, and he said, let's go out in the wilderness. Let's go over to this place we've never been. Let's investigate. Urging or imposing that wish on others, right?
Can you think of one, Yannis?
Always wanted to live in the woods. Yeah. As a kid. Mm-hmm. Never in the woods or in the woods.
Yeah. In a cabin.
Yeah.
Live in the wilderness.
Run away from home. I had to get to Canada when I was 15.
There you go. Mm-hmm. See? And you'll find many other examples because Celestics is biographically incredibly rich. The proof of Celestics is in the biographic evidence, not in the psychological evidence. It's not a method of psychological analysis. Okay? So then we look at the south node. That is the point, rather the point of, instead of I'm a child and you're my pal and I'm kind of pushing something on you, is when I want to pull you toward me. I want your empathy. See? And that's the south node. And in Jonas's case, that was in the chest of the lion. Well, the chest of the lion, I'm just working this out now, represents something that I would call the sense of racial identity and ancestral identity. Okay? So what Jonas wanted, you know, to say, I have something in me. Maybe I can't say exactly what it is, but I can tell you how it feels. And later on in life, you come to realize that it's your intense passion for ancestry and racial identity. And you have it in you, but it's inchoate, it's inarticulate. But still, you want to get someone else interested in what's inside you. And then, you know, whether your attempt is successful or not, go back and look at the events of your life, you know. And so that's the factor of empathy, the south node in the breast or chest of the lion. Because the chest of the lion is ancestral pride. It's racial identity. And I must say, Jonas, that you are one of the masters of the study of racial identities. And you've been able to delve into an area which is of the Russian Slavic identity, which I have not been able to do because you have to go to original sources.
Only with that.
Yeah.
Slavic.
Yeah.
Baltic.
Yeah, what is the Baltic identity, you see? This is something that you was brewing in you from a child.
Yes.
And you wanted to get other children interested. That's the point of empathy. You've done a tremendous job on that. You really have. Developed a lot of knowledge about racial identity. So then we come to the apogee of the moon, and that is also in the same area of the chest of the lion. So you have both the south node and the apogee in that area. It gives a double emphasis. So the apogee of the moon, can you see that?
Yeah.
The apogee of the moon represents the ability that everyone has of an extraordinary talent. All the other planets, which are called assets in the manifold, are talents that everyone has. We're all born in life with a toolkit. Mother Nature gives you a toolkit of talents, and these are the planets. They're your assets. But two of them that you have in your toolbox are tools of extraordinary and exceptional development, and that's the apogee and the perigee. So the apogee talent is the ability to see things in a great, great picture. To just put everything together and form a great overview of things. So you also have that ability to do that with the racial and ancestral knowledge. You know, you can see the whole picture, oversee it.
And it's about the true nobility of humanity, isn't it? The true aristocracy, right. The lion
is the true spiritual aristocracy and the racial aristocracy. Then the perigee is that exceptional skill that allows you to investigate something and go into the particulars of something in great, great depth. That's the difference between skill for an overview and skill for focus, sort of like the difference between a telescope and a microscope, right? So
the outer and inner focus.
So interestingly, curiously, you have the perigee in the great void, but it's right on the nose of the goldfish. You see that?
Yeah.
That's the lunar perigee, right? Mm-hmm. So it's in the great void, but the goldfish is looking down, you know, into gazing down. I would say it's in the gaze of the goldfish.
Yeah.
And so that means that your investigative skill goes to the subject of the guidance of humanity. You know, who are the gods? Who do we look to guide humanity? You know, they were called the Manus, they were called the Viracocha, they're called by various names, right? And in modern day life, who do you look for guidance? So with the perigee in that area, you have the ability to look, for instance, at systems of metaphysics or spiritual programs presented by certain masters and to take them apart in great detail and analyze them.
Dissect them.
Pick up what works and leave the rest behind.
Pick up what works and leave the rest. Yeah.
Throw away the rubble.
And you've done that with quite a number of, let's say, so-called leading spiritual gurus of our time. You know, you looked at them. And also political. You look at Marx. And you bring that critical focus to the program and to the authority, the presumed authority. And you have that ability to do that. So that's what the perigee in the gaze of the goldfish indicates. Okay?
But we are actually looking at a man who is fulfilling his endowment.
Yeah, because if you were not fulfilling your endowment, what I'm saying would make absolutely no sense to you. It would sound like gibberish.
Gibberish.
I'd be just glazed.
Yeah, your eyes would be glazed because your life and your behavior and your studies is the biographic evidence that you are fulfilling this. So if I'm talking to someone else who has the same manifold as you, and many people do have the same manifold, by the way, and I'm telling them the same things that I'm telling Jonas, they're going to go like, what are you talking about? I don't have anything to do with that. I'm not interested in that at all. And in every birth, there's a throw of the dice. You know, thousands of people have your manifold, tens of thousands. But only a very few of those manifest and fulfill what's in it. This is a lesson of celestics, which is quite a blow to astrological clients who like to believe that they're incredibly special. There's nothing special about you. What makes you special is what you do with what you got on your plate, you see? I can't believe we're doing all 12 of these.
It's good manifolding.
It is. It's easy to do.
Yeah.
So then we look at Mercury and Venus. And these two assets represent, Mercury represents intellectual discernment and the ability to read and the ability to be literate. And of course you are extremely literate. You speak several languages. So it's a skill for those activities, and quite strikingly, you have Mercury at the throat of the bull, conjunct the Pleiades, right? So this is really stunning. the throat of the bull then is the expression of the power of imagination, which is something that you can grasp because you have the mental ability with languages and reading and writing, a highly developed skill to do that. You know, see, the constellation does not show personality type. Okay, so most astrologers would say, okay, Jonas is a Gemini, that's his personality type, but he has the sun in the bull. Does that mean that he has a bull type personality? No. Because the information of the constellations is not personal, it's transpersonal.
And actually the bull in Celestics is not a male character.
That's right, it's female.
It's female.
Strangely enough.
Which is a paradox.
Yeah.
The bull mother of the Aeonic mother. Right? So Mercury is discernment, intellectual discernment, and Venus is sensibility. So Venus is the asset through which you develop your taste for food, your taste for culture, for dress, for your taste in art, music, in everything. Your taste in where you like to live, where you don't like to live. That's your sense, Venusian sensibility. Okay? And you have Venus in 28 Cancer. Now this is where I have to consult the master chart. Says 118, right? Round it off.
Right. 118.
That is in a really unique position. Because that is at the celestial anchor.
Get in.
Get in. Stop it. So the celestial anchor is obviously a new addition to the zodiac, which has been worked out.
Your good self added.
So first of all, you know, how would you read that? Sorry, Venus at the celestial anchor. By the way, that's a local flush with me. I have Saturn at the celestial anchor. And I have the biographic proof of that in my work as the navigator, obviously. Right? So it's sort of like saying, okay, Venus at the anchor, it's like saying, well, you could like a lot of things, you could have this taste for this music, and that taste for this food. But essentially, you just want to get to the root of things. Your sensibility only cares about what matters in the deepest sense. So in a way, a lot of things that would matter to other people, a lot of their preferences and taste, you say, it's arbitrary. Who cares about that? My taste is to find out what pulls this whole show together. So your anchor, that's the anchor constellation, you see? That's how I would read that. What would you say, Vanessa? She disappeared, checking her brain. Okay? So that's really brilliant. So next we come to the three planets, Mars, Jupiter, and Saturn. Remember, in the manifold language, we call them assets. They're tools. But there's a difference between, an important difference in the syntax of Celestics, and you would get this immediately. There's a difference between a capacity and a skill. So you might say, well, you have a capacity to play music, but you do not necessarily have a skill, right? Because you have to train and practice. So these assets are capacities, and we never assume that they're working, because we have to look at the individual and say, well, what have you done with that capacity? Have you developed it into a skill? And can you give me the fucking evidence that you have that skill?
Can you play the tune?
Can you play the tune? Can you play the instrument? See? So Celestics is so provable on the basis of the evidence of behavior. See? It's one of the things that distinguishes it from astrology, which is largely like theoretical bullshit about what a wonderful person you are. I like to say to people in Celestica, 30,000 people have the same manifold as you. Explain that. How come you're a unique snowflake? You're just a throw of the dice. You're like the dropping of the acorn seeds of the tree. And most of them die, but only a few of them go into other trees. This is a brutal fact. So celestial. So we'll quickly go through these. Can't believe we're going through them all. Or maybe I'll just pick one that's easy.
Mars is really easy.
Mars is your defiance and your daring. You're daring to question things. You're daring to go into areas that are unknown. You're daring to challenge people, right? And that is, again, that is 99 on the ecliptic, which is in the legs or knees of the twins. Now, the twins represent, it's very important to know that they represent conversation. And they represent everything that happens in a gender binary, in a dynamic of a dialectic. So Socrates said, look, I'm not here to tell you anything I already know, or you think you fucking know, but you don't. We're here to have a conversation back and forth to get to something that we don't know yet, right? That's the essence of dialectic, which is a twin's power. So you challenge people through your Martian defiance to do dialectic with you. It says, let's not bullshit each other. Let's not just say, I think this and you think that about politics. Let's get into a rolling conversation. And that's a skill that you demonstrate. He's grinning. Your friend is grinning. Every time.
Even he knows it's true.
Every time Jonas comes and reports to us on conversations he's had with a person, it's exactly the same syndrome. It's exactly what he's doing. That's your Mars. Self-assertion. You assert yourself by inviting and challenging people into conversation.
The twins is also can be associated with boxers, you know, mm-hmm. sparring.
Yeah.
And you spar intellectually.
Intellectual sparring.
Yeah. So I'll do Jupiter in a second quickly.
Yes,
okay.
You shall.
So Jupiter is in 27 Libra, so that's in the knees of the Virgin, and we correlate that to devotion to Sophia's story.
Mm-hmm.
That's really straightforward. And your so Jupiter's your social message. Your social message is about devotion to Sophia, who she is, her story. Saturn, which is your social mission, is in 18 Taurus, which is in the ram.
Ooh.
In the legs of the ram.
I saw a ram and it jumped that high.
My ram can jump.
No,
that
my
high.
Ram jumps high.
That high.
Way up there.
We're doing the Roman salute. The purposes of the
so this means that your social message, which you carry and negotiate with people, you leak it to them in various ways, you know, is about we're animals created by a divine mother. Let's recognize her and be devoted and reverent toward our mother. That you carry the spirit of that devotion with Jupiter. But with Saturn, you carry an ideological mission. And that's like the hammer, you know. You can sweet talk them about loving the Virgin Sophia, and then you hit them on the head with a mallet, like Nietzsche said, philosophize with a mallet, with a hammer. You say you teach them the brutal facts of ideology, because the ram is racial ideology.
So Isabella of Spain, Hitler, very much loaded in the ram. Which is why they achieved what they did.
Right. They brought an ideology and a moral code to their people. So your mission is to carry that moral code and to assert that moral code. That's your social mission.
My mission is that too.
Yeah.
So, yes. Of course.
Great. So now we come to the outermost planets. Now, as we observed before we start recording, there are multiple minute and sophisticated fluctuations because some of the planets move really fast and some of them move really slow. So the outermost planets, which are also called the trans-Saturnians, are Uranus, Neptune, and Pluto. And they have really long cycles. So that means that many people in one generation will have these planets in exactly the same positions. So what we call them in the syntax of celestics is their generation factors. They belong to your generation. They do not refer to you individually, but to you as a member of
your generation.
Your zeitgeist.
Your zeitgeist, exactly. And the other syntax, before we look at this and comment, that's really brilliant, I think, in celestics, is that it absolutely changes the astrological interpretations of these planets. So it gives you a new language. For instance, Uranus, say you're facing generational issues. We all face generational issues because they come with the generation we're born into. But how do you face those generational issues? Well, there are three ways that you do it. You do it by interactions with other members of your generation. But there are three kinds of interactions. First kind is one-to-one. So when you talk one-to-one to someone else in your generation, you express your Uranian talent, which is a savvy of looking at things originally. Saying, hey, let's not assume this, let's not assume that. We've been told this. I was brought up in the 60s. I was told this. No, I think it's this. And it's a one-to-one contact. That's Uranus. Neptune, on the other hand, is the way you behave, and this is really complicated. Neptune is an indicator of in-group and out-group relationships. So when you are using the Neptune asset, you're not talking to an individual, you're talking to a group of people. So for instance, if you're in a bar with some people of your own age range, your peers, you know, and you start to talk to them about something, you're using the Neptunian faculty. Because when you talk to a group of people sitting around in a bar or at dinner or in a classroom, it's a different delivery. You're not talking one to one.
It's a different dynamic. Yeah.
And one of the things about Neptune, which I'm learning, because it's very complicated to analyze in-group, out-group relationships. But obviously, everything in society is in-group or out-group. You're either in it or you're out of it, right? You're either left or you're not. You know, you're either Marxist or you're not. You're either feminist or you're not. And one of the things I've come to realize about my Neptune is that it involves a factor of magnetism and casting a spell over people, enchanting them. Neptune is the enchanter. So when you put me in a room with a group of people, no matter what the social setting is, if I act on my Neptune asset, I will enchant them. I will use a certain kind of charisma or magnetism of my personality to get them to listen to me and to follow what I have to tell them. See? And in my particular case, it's a beautiful indication here in my telescope. You find Neptune in Libra in the fourth house. So this is how we read this, get this. Well, John, it's obvious that you have this magnetic ability to enchant people, to capture their minds with what you're relating to them, as I do with the fallen goddess Sun. And you have Neptune at the Grail Cup. And one of the things that results from using the Neptune asset is that you create a cult around yourself. And I have created a cult around myself based on the Grail legend. See what I mean?
The other members.
And the beautiful thing about it is the fourth house, the fourth facet in astrology means the end of the life, end of life, or where you are in life, or the situation that you find yourself in at the end of life. So it says, John, you're going to find yourself in a situation where you're a cult-like leader and you have hypnotized and spellbound these people. You're in group, and that will be the setting for the end of your life. It's absolutely crystal clear. Okay?
So Pluto,
so
now we go to Pluto. So Pluto is mysterious. It's a little difficult to interpret how Pluto works, because if I were to ask you, you know, you can understand that you have one-to-one contact with your generation, people of your generation. You have kind of a group setting. But Pluto is a collective. It's the masses. And how can any one of us as an individual affect the masses? Because we're never in the presence of the masses. You'd have to be in the presence of the entire world, right? So it raises this question. It's a very interesting question. And I can't say I can answer it adequately, but I'll give it my best shot. You see, the way that you walk around in the world and you walk among the masses, not the entire population, but you're out at a train station or you're in a concert, in some place where you're with more than, say, a small group of people.
In a crowd,
right? And so there you are walking in a crowd, like I'm walking in my elk jacket through the Gare du Montparnasse, you know?
During COVID. No mask on.
Right. And I'm in the collective, but nobody knows who I am, nor do they need to have to know, because my mere presence in the collective anonymously conveys a message to the collective. And that's how the Pluto function works. Okay? So if we want to know what message is it that you convey to the collective anonymously, without them even knowing it, then you look at the constellation that Pluto is, and it is in 175.
The Uranus.
Yeah. And 175, I have to check the master list, is in, this is very hard for you, it's in the Virgin, and it's in the middle part of the Virgin. So whether they know it or not, you are carrying what you know and feel about the Virgin, the Aeons of Fire. You carry that, her impact directly. You're like her emissary, but you don't have to confront anyone, because you can't confront people en masse. You know, I suppose if you had the chance to give a talk in a football stadium at Wembley, like David Icke did, you could say, well, in a sense, we could say David Icke is exercising his platonic power because he's addressing a mass of people. But ordinarily, we don't get that ability. The greatest mass that I was able to address was 1,000 people at the Tavistock Institute in London.
Tavistock Institute.
It's on my record, guilty as charged. I lectured at the Tavistock Institute.
So how can one be an effective agent of the Plutonian talent in the masses if they don't get the opportunity to speak? Is it going to be the way you carry yourself?
Yeah, it's just the way you carry your stance and the way you hold your power when you're in a crowd and you get lost in the sauce. It's the way you stand out and you're impressing them, but you're doing it anonymously. They don't really know who you are.
So aura?
Your aura and your stance that you take affects the mass. And that's the Plutonic factor, which, as you can see, it's a little difficult to describe it exactly. Of course, if you get the opportunity, I would say that addressing 1,000 people in a lecture hall was a Plutonian thing. And so where is my Pluto? Well, my Pluto is in the crab, you know, the scarab, the crab, Spider Woman. And what I did, what did I do at that lecture? I gave a talk on, I can't remember what it was, but at that point, the effect that I had on those people was the effect of the crab, which is Tantra Mother, which is teaching the education of the human species, you know. So I was an educator teaching them my notion about humanity and the proper way for us to organize our world. That's all the crab, you see. I can't remember. I gave a talk to about 600 people at the School of Economics in London.
Well,
but that was on Kali Yuga. That was a very big hit. But I can't remember what I talked about at Tavistock. So anyway, that's how that works. So finally we come to the last factor, which is called Chiron. And Chiron is not a planet, it's a comet-like body, an asteroid. And it's a subject of enormous debate in astrology, whether you should include Chiron, what does Chiron mean, and so forth. And once again, I'll finish with another blowing my horn for another 3 minutes. At great pains and with great difficulty, I broke down this concept of Chiron, and I decided that I was completely wrong. And the reason why I was wrong is very interesting. The astronomer who discovered Chiron, I forget his name, was also interested in mythology by chance. And there's an international body called the International Astronomical Union. And when anyone discovers a new comet, like this comet Nakamura, they give the discoverer, they name it after the discoverer, or they give the discoverer the privilege of naming it. So they discovered this weird body of Chiron, which has very strange behavior. It has a 52-year cycle, and it comes into the solar system, and comes in past the orbit of Saturn, and then goes out again, and then comes in again. You know? And the man who discovered it had an interest in mythology, and so he chose to connect it with Chiron, which is the centaur in Greek myth. That was a mistake. That was a complete mistake, because the mythological figure of Chiron is associated with the image of the wounded healer. And so all astrologers today read Chiron according to that syndrome, and it's entirely wrong. So what I had to do was work out another identity, another mythological identity for Chiron, and I renamed it Seshat. It's an Egyptian name, because it never worked. We were working in celestics like crazy when I gave the celestics training course, and like grappling. It's like using the wrong tool for the wrong purpose. You know, you're trying to use a wrench when you need to use a drill, right? And we had struggled with it like crazy, didn't we? You could make it fit, because if you manipulated the notion in your own mind, you could make the concept fit, but it never really felt comfortable. Finally, well, not too long ago, how long ago was it, Vanessa? 2 years?
No,
less.
Last year.
I broke it down and I realized that there's a more appropriate mythological identity for Chiron, which is Seshat. And Seshat is the Egyptian goddess who keeps the record of history. So Chiron is actually about history and about the ability of your mind to study and comprehend historical narratives. And one thing that I would advise about Chiron, and I stand strongly on this point, if you, the individual client of Celestics, have no interest in history, then you can discard Chiron, because it only manifests the people who are interested in looking at the historical record and historical revision. So there's actually a faculty of historical revision in Celestics now. Mm. And that's Chiron.
I think I'm right in saying that David Irving's Earth is around here somewhere.
Yeah. So we're looking at historical revisionists, and they're checking out that their Chiron makes sense. The constellation where they have Chiron makes sense. So Chiron here is in 12 degrees of Aries, which is near the perihelion of Jupiter, and that is the whole story of Western civilization. The whole trajectory of Western civilization is in the cord that goes to the tail of the Western whale that swims toward the Manitou. That's the whole trajectory of Western history in its entirety. And so what you have with your Chiron skill is the ability to evaluate and rewrite that narrative.
We can relate to that.
I think so.
Yeah, that works.
It seems to be oddly fitting.
Doesn't it?
So we appear to have covered it. Oh, I'll just mention the ascendant. So the correct ascendant is 28 Scorpio. That's my Venus. Yes. It's a good excuse, you know, to get along. But that is the correction point. That is the point where the claw of the scorpion hits the bar of the scales. And so your
the pan,
the pan of the scale. Pan. No, it hits the crossbar, doesn't
right.
hit the
yeah.
pan. The pans are hanging. It's the crossbar,
it's
and
the
pans go like this. So you carry that correction factor, which is a powerful factor because it challenges everything. You've got to look at what's wrong with everything.
Shakes from the foundation, yes.
So what you and I have in common, one of the things is that from a very early age, I can remember that I looked around. You know how you get a child squints, squint out my face, and I said, what is wrong? Something is wrong here, but I don't fucking know what it is. But I saw it and I sensed it. You see, that's the vision of the scorpion, the eight eyes of the scorpion. That's eight eyes on its head. It sees what is wrong. So we both had an intense sense in our early life, from our early life, that there was something that was really wrong with everything. It, something essentially is wrong, and it makes everything else go wrong. And now, of course, we know what that is. Who that is. What that is. What
had that very
what
strong
type of
when I thought that my grandparents got robbed, my parents got robbed, and that I'm getting robbed
by the system.
Well,
and I wanted to understand.
Yeah,
what is it?
For the purpose of this recording, Jonas actually grew up in the Soviet Union. Did you not?
He did, yes,
and served in the Russian army.
Yeah.
Just thought I'd mention that. Kicks.
Yeah.
Yeah, when I looked at my parents, I remember being in the kitchen and my stepfather would come home from the lobster fishing around 4 and they would sit there and we'd usually eat at 6 and they would have a cup of coffee together and they'd put evaporated milk in it.
But didn't eat lobster.
Yeah. And one day my stepfather comes home. Then he puts 2 cans of evaporated milk on the table since they're going to put it in their coffee that they drink while they talk about the day. And he says, oh, look, the evaporated milk. It was 13 cents a can last week and now it's 15. And we were in shock. That's how poor we were, right? And I sat there and I watched them and listened to the conversation. First of all, I fucking hated them for being so weak, you know? But at the same time, I knew, they're reacting because something is wrong, but I don't know what it is. But the price of evaporated milk that cannot go up in 2 cents in a week, something is wrong, you know? That's how you pick up on that. It's wonderful because all the biographical evidence that you can gather confirms this. It's the only way to confirm it. It's not theoretical.
As long as you don't forget what you've seen and felt.
Mm.
And then when you go to school, you're in school and they're trying to teach you something, and what do you think? I want to learn, I have a great passion to learn, but this is wrong. This is the wrong way to learn.
They're trying to brainwash me.
Yeah. Before you knew the word brainwash.
Yes.
And not let you build a phone.
Yeah. That's what I learned by the phones.
That's a personal anecdote. Muy bien. Excellent.
Listo.
Listo. Any questions?
Ascendant? You weren't talking about ascendant?
Yeah.
Is that the correct ascendant for?
Yes.
You sure it's correct?
I checked it with astrologers.
Okay, what is it?
It's 20...
No, that's mine.
Yeah. 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 27 Virgo.
I'm going to check
that. Jonas is 28 Scorpio. See, this is not correct.
Yeah, it's but I checked this one against Astro Dinks and it was all correct. So please
tell me what it is again.
27 Virgo.
Okay, this is how you play that one. There is a star in the constellation of the Virgin at the tail, and the constellation of the Lion. So it's in the sign Virgo, but it's in the constellation of the Lion.
It's a nebula.
Yeah. That star is right there.
What's it?
The nebula.
It's called the nebula. It's right there.
That one.
So you have the body of the lion, and it's leaping, roaring, and then you have the head of the lion and the mane, and it's leaping and roaring. It's important to visualize it. It's also important, this is one, again, benefit of celestics, it connects you to the sky. You've got to look at this. Once you know what is encoded in those constellations, and once you know point by point how it relates to you, when you go out and look at them, something happens. Because that constellation is an engram. It's like an engram in your mind, but it's also an engram in the sky. And when you make the visual connection, when you look at the heart star, I used to call it that, when you look at Antares in the scorpion, which is where I was born.
Which is red.
And you know that your sun, the sun was there when you were born, and then you know the mythography of the constellation, it's a download. It downloads into your mind. So the nebula is the tail of the lion, and that's the star that was rising when you were born, at the hour you were born, right?
Yes, exactly.
We will get along. No wonder I'd like to look at that dude. Right. That's the race romantic ethos. We can talk about that at dinner. Anyway. The tail of the lion, the tail star, is right above the head of the Virgin. So here's the huge constellation of the Virgin. Here's the lion, and the tail star is right above her head. And this tail star represents the tail of the lion. It's a pun. It's not only le cœur, but it's the histoire, the légende. And what is the legend of the lion? Well, it's a story of all the great heroes that truly represented the nobility of their races, you see? And you carry that knowledge, you have the ability to tap that knowledge and to learn who those heroes were, you know, the French heroes, the Roland, the German heroes, the race heroes. It's about the narrative of racial heroism. That's what that star is about. And that's your guiding star. So you can frame your whole growth as a person in that framework, you see? Making sense?
Yeah. Okay. There was something about Celtic race that
The lion
long lions, ago that you did first interpretation many years ago.
I gave a course on comparative mythology, and I linked the different mythic matrices with constellations, and I strongly associated the Celtic races with the lion, you know?
That fits
beautifully, because they had a nobility, but it was not a hierarchical nobility, it was a clan nobility.
Okay, so a good case in point, Boudica.
Mm-hmm.
Boudica, she was a British Celt who
fought the Romans
as best she could.
Yeah. So it's stories like that, and heroes like that, that would be beacons to you to develop your own role in life, which is the ascendant is how you develop your role in life, how you create your own role, which is not a social role. It's not a social role, it's a transpersonal role.
Or socialist role.
Transsocialist. Okay, Lisa.
That's enough then. Okay.